wrap up the algorithms overview, I'm done with digging into the details and explain to you how they work. Hopefully you've got a little bit of a taste of how we analyze and, some of the key quantum algorithms. A lot of work has been done over the years, and so I mentioned that there's quantum searching, which in a sense, so what it does is, So what quantum amplitude amplification does is it takes some algorithm A, so it could be any classical algorithm or quantum algorithm that takes some input string of zeros and produces a quantum state. This quantum state has some amplitude, say sine theta being what you want, but some amplitude cos theta being something you don't want. Typically, sine theta is very, very small. So this is, you could take an algorithm that guesses, finds a solution with small probability p equal to sine squared theta, turn it into a quantum algorithm by standard methods. So now you have a quantum procedure that creates a state where the solution you want has amplitude square root of p. And instead of having to repeat p times, you can repeat square root of p times. So it amplifies the amplitude of the good states by sine 2k plus 1 theta. This is a very general purpose primitive. And so one thing people have worked on over the years, and we're still working on, is what I would call non-trivial applications of this tool. So one algorithm, and a lot of these aren't super complicated, but it does take a bit of effort to turn it into an algorithm for not finding f at x equal to 1, but finding the minimum value of f at, finding an x such that f at x is minimum. Yes?
What are trivial applications of amplitude?
Well, one that is more or less just like straightforward, like just an application of the problem, where you have a circuit, you have a function that you know how to evaluate, and you want to find an input with a certain property. Like that's essentially the algorithm itself. So very often you can take your problem and directly massage it into that form. There's really nothing new other than you're applying this algorithm.
The minimum maximum finding is exactly that, right?
Okay, so how do you do it? Tell me how to do it then, if you're claiming it's trivial.
Well,
it's not that hard. Like, it's one of the easier applications.
What you just said is you quantify a certain property and then you look for the element of that property.
So how do you verify efficiently that the minimum value of f at x is 27?
I'm just asking, what is a trivial application?
Yeah, yeah.
And you said you look for some property. Minimum is a property.
Yeah, a property that is efficiently checkable. That's an important point then.
Okay. So NP.
So something in NP, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So these are varying degrees of easy, but I think it does require a bit of, so that's an important point. You do need, you know, this f at x has to be something you can efficiently compute. Right. So if you can easily massage into that form, then it's done. Something less trivial is finding, you know, it wasn't super hard, but you can use this as a subroutine to find the minimum or maximum of a function. It did take a little bit of skill for my colleagues Hoyer and Durer to do that. Collision finding takes a little more skill. You want to find, you know, an x and a y such that f at x equals f at y. So I'm not looking for a specific preimage. I want to find a collision. So again, you can use the amplitude amplification as a subroutine. String matching. Here's a really, really long string of bits. Find this substring somewhere in there, right? And you can use amplitude amplification as a subroutine. De-randomizing, making certain algorithms exact. So with quantum searching, if you know the probability of success exactly, you can turn it into something that works with probability exactly one. So in practice, who cares? But it's interesting. If you ever want to do that, amplitude amplification is a tool for taking something that works with a known probability and turns it into something that works with probability one, which classically you can't do. You can repeat as many times as you like classically. There's always a chance you always fail. And many graph problems, like you specify a graph implicitly. and you want to find certain structures within the graph, and so on. I mean, I don't want to belabor this, but there are some algorithms which there's maybe some complicated algorithm which has a search subroutine, and you have to put amplitude amplification in there. Those are other applications. You can generalize the abelian hidden subgroup problem in several different ways. You can think of the abelian, so the abelian hidden subgroup problem is a generalization of the factoring and discrete log algorithms. So it's a generalization of Shor's factoring algorithm and Simon's algorithm, which I mentioned early on, which you can think of as finding a sublattice of a lattice. Okay. So you can think of having Z tensors, actually, I don't mean tensor product. I just mean Cartesian product. Z cross Z cross Z. So let's just do Z squared. You have an integer lattice. This is just the integer lattice. And you can define, you can pick a point out here and another point here, right? These two vectors in your lattice will define, a sub, it's not a very good drawing, but we'll define a sublattice. And so on. This is a poorly drawn sublattice, but I hope you get what I intend. These are supposed to be all equivalent. So I got the, so we'll define a sublattice with, a principal. In fact, so it gets interesting when you, let me try to think of a combination that's not so trivial here. Well, this might be, you want ones where when you span it all out, you do end up getting short vectors. You might have a principal, you might get points that are actually very small. When you take these linear combinations, plus and minus, you might start with big vectors, but they add up to some small vectors. Okay. I'm getting ahead of myself into the cryptography lecture. So let's just imagine there's a sublattice of this lattice. Okay. That's in a sense a subgroup of the group. If you treat the lattice as a group, it's a subgroup. If I define a function which is constant on this sublattice, that always has the same value on this sublattice, and any shifted version of that sublattice, it's a different constant value. So in other words, I define a function such that f at x is equal to f at y if and only if the difference between x and y is in this lattice. This lattice is a set of subpoints. That's a hidden lattice problem, which is like a hidden subgroup problem. And quantum computers are really good at finding that hidden lattice if you implicitly define it with such a function. So if you magically have an efficient way to compute such a function, which is hiding this lattice in a sense, I mean, classically it's very hard to find this lattice if all you have is such a function. A quantum computer can find it right away. You can generalize this further and imagine a sublattice of the real numbers. You have Rn. It gets a bit messy because you can't specify things exactly anymore. But there's many well-known number theory problems that reduce to finding or approximating hidden sublattices of a lattice, such as solving Pell's equations, the principal ideal problem, and unit groups of number fields, and so on. So there's been a lot of nice number theory work in this area. I think I did define the hidden subgroup problem. I did define the hidden subgroup problem last class, right? Just very quickly. So these are sort of generalizations that some we don't know how to solve and some we have found clever solutions for. And some of them solve problems we care about, okay? Often we'll just define the problem because we know we have an efficient quantum algorithm for it, but nobody cares about that problem, not yet. But other times, in this case, thanks to Sean Holgren and others, we've solved some very interesting number theory problems. And there's different versions. Instead of hiding a subgroup, you might hide a shift inside a function, like f at x is equal to f at x plus r. sorry, f at x is equal to g at x plus r for some hidden r. What's r? You might try to hide nonlinear structures. There's another problem called Gauss sums, which is nice because there's no black box there. You just give the integer, you give the parameters, and compute this sum in a quantum computer. Yes?
Don't you mean that for a certain period, it keeps incrementing? You said
which
f
one?
Of x equals g of x plus r.
Yeah, so imagine...
That seems classically pretty easy and solvable, right?
No. So I give you a means for computing f. You know, mapping, you know, integers to some set x and g. So f and g both, right? And I say, well, f at x is equal to g, is equal to g at x plus r. Find r.
Okay.
That's not so easy.
Okay. No, I thought the
yeah.
r was outside.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be easy, yeah. Gauss sums is another problem. Where it's nice because there's no magic black box that somebody falls from the sky and doesn't, we don't really have good examples in practice. A really interesting paradigm for finding quantum algorithms is based on random walks. So random walks are a very powerful method in computer science. So if you can walk through, say, a solution space, you know, an assignment of variables to a three-sat equation, right? A lot of good algorithms for trying to find the, you know, almost optimum solutions to a formula involve just randomly walking from one approximate solution to another for some period of time, for example. But quantum walks, these random walks, which are essentially Markov chain type algorithms, are a powerful method in classical computer science. So people have found ways to generalize them and imagine, instead of starting from a point and randomly walking through the graph, what if you can be in a coherent superposition of different points in the graph, and then update that, and so on. Can you solve some problems more efficiently that way? So with classical random walks, there's often two things you want to do. You want to essentially randomly sample some set. That's a thing we often want to do. That's called the mixing time. Sorry. So how many steps do you have to make before you're essentially at a random point in the set? And often it's a lot of steps. But for a good algorithm, you can converge to that point quickly. And quantum walks, for some special cases, have a quadratically faster hitting time. So instead of n steps, it's square root of n steps, sorry, for a mixing time, which can be useful for solving some combinatorial problems. Hitting time is a different problem, which is I'm not trying to get a random sample. I'm trying to find a point in that graph with a special property. Okay. So if the graph is, these are sort of virtual graphs. The nodes are n-bit strings that are solution or are assignments of variables to an equation. And you walk from one assignment to another to another. So there's a virtual graph which consists of all the solutions, and the two solutions are connected if your algorithm walks from this solution to this other solution with non-zero probability. So you're walking around this virtual space. The space itself is exponentially large. You're walking through it. You're trying to find a string with a certain property. Like this string is the ground state of this Ising spin system, right? So you might be walking from one assignment of the spin variables to another, to another, to another, okay? So one aim for mixing time, you want to eventually get to a random assignment. But hitting time means I want to find that ground state, right? Or a state with a certain energy as fast as possible. And for some, you know, heavily concocted algorithms, we can get exponential speedups for hitting times. Richard Cleave, Andrew Childs, and others came up with a nice example there. And you can solve interesting questions like AND-OR trees, min-max trees. I implicitly define a graph. I want to know if there's a triangle in the graph. Again, it's not to draw the picture of the graph because then you can easily check it. We're talking about a graph with exponentially many vertices. You have a way of asking, is vertex 27 joined to vertex 42? Yes or no? That's all you're allowed to ask. Now find me a triangle. Okay. The best algorithm is a walk-based algorithm. Again, inspired by classical random walks.
That can never be deterministic, right?
It can be.
Walking, but how can you ever show that it's, by just like walking around, how can you ever show that you're never going to get there?
Why would you never want? What do you mean? Usually,
isn't the question if I have like a really, really big graph?
Yeah.
Like, is this node connected to that one?
That's connected. I mean joined. So you have a way of verifying whether two vertices. Let's assume it's a connected graph. So there is a path between any two vertices. I mean, that's an assumption. A lot of graph problems don't need that assumption. Actually, we don't even need that assumption.
What do you mean by joined?
Joined means there's an edge between them. There's a direct edge, yeah. So joined means there's a direct edge between them. Connected is the notion of there's some sort of path from one to the other.
So how are you going to solve that by walking around? Don't you just like go through all the edges that one of your vertices has?
So it's a non-trivial, it's what I would call a non-trivial algorithm. So you can solve it. I mean, there's many ways to solve it. You can look over all triples. That could be, you could look over all triples of points and query and ask the three questions.
Like, so again, what do you mean by joins?
Joined means there's.
You mean it's that what, there's a vertex, like
so,
one intermediate vertex, that there's a path of distance two between joins.
So joined means, so I and J are vertices. I is joined to J, or I and J are joined. So then there's an edge set. And there's an edge set if you know if I and J are in the edge set. So if you think of a graph, this is the graph theory, standard graph theory language. So 1 and 2 are joined, 2 and 3 are joined, 2 and 4 are not joined.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So if I want to decide, is there a triangle in this graph? And all you're allowed to do is ask questions of the form, are vertex 2 and 5 joined or not? Right. So you can keep asking and asking. There's a certain number of queries needed to correctly answer that question with high probability.
So what's the goal of the algorithm?
The goal of the algorithm from
2 to 4, or to find out whether 2 and 4 are joined?
So the aim of this triangle finding algorithm, well, there's two versions. There's the decision version or the search version. So let's say the search version. The search version says, find me a triangle if one exists.
What's a triangle?
A triangle is, well, we don't have one here, so it's not a good example, but I'll put one in. A triangle is like 3, 6, 4. So it's three vertices that are pairwise joined. So that's a triangle. And if I want to find, anyway, thanks for asking the questions. If I want to find a triangle in such a graph, but it's abstractly defined, you're just allowed to ask whether two vertices are joined. There's a certain number of queries you need for a classical algorithm. And there's a quantum algorithm that's a little bit better, but the best quantum algorithm is one of these quantum walk algorithms. I'm not going to be able to explain how the quantum walk algorithm works, but Grover, like amplitude amplification doesn't help as much as the quantum walk algorithm does here. I'm not getting into the details of this algorithm, but that's the problem it solves. It'll spit out a 3, 4, 6, if there one exists. And if it can't find one, it's probably because it doesn't exist. Okay. Another algorithmic idea that you may have heard of from our colleagues at MIT, it's based on the adiabatic theorem. So the idea is simple. I mean, I imagine you're all familiar with the adiabatic theorem. If Hamiltonian starts H0, starts off in a ground state Psi0, if you change the Hamiltonian slowly enough, it always stays in its ground state, right? So the algorithmic paradigm is, imagine there's a final Hamiltonian with a ground state that's NP-hard. This could be the ground state of some Ising system that's known to be NP-hard, for example. So start off in a Hamiltonian where the ground state is easy to find. Start in the ground state, start simulating that Hamiltonian, change the Hamiltonian slowly, so it eventually changes to H1. With high probability, if you went slowly enough, whatever that means, you'll end up in its ground state, which is a really hard problem. It's a solution to your you know, spin system question or whatever your favorite question is. So that's an idea. That's a new algorithmic approach. It works if you go slow enough. What's hard to know is there an interesting problem where slow enough is still faster than the best known classical algorithm? We've shown that you can at least get quadratic speed up with this approach. And with a slight generalization of this approach, something we call adiabatic computation, you can actually fully capture the power of quantum computing. So it's an interesting algorithmic paradigm. I can't really point to many home runs that we were able to solve in this paradigm where a more conventional paradigm didn't work. But there are there are examples. And it's a valid algorithmic paradigm. It's a very clever idea. I would say the quantum walk paradigm has been more fruitful over the years than the adiabatic approach. Topological algorithms are another example. Just quickly skip over that. And often we need algorithms where there's a quantum input and a quantum output. Okay, so there's no... the aim isn't to answer some classical question. We need to compress a quantum state into another quantum state. We need to do quantum error correction and so on, to concentrate entanglement. So there's many algorithms for doing those tasks. There's a few surveys I'll leave you with. The latest, you know, that I list here is Ashley Montanaro's at Bristol, and our colleague Stephen Jordan at NIST maintains a whole list of algorithms. The point I want to leave you with is, you may have heard, you know, as I think I said yesterday or 2 days ago, the claim people say there's only two algorithms, Shor and Grover, and that's it. That's just not true. It was never true even in the beginning because we had the Hamiltonian simulation algorithm. And there's just many, many other non-trivial algorithms that go far beyond the ideas of amplitude amplification and hidden subgroup. I want to now switch gears and walk you through some of the basics of cybersecurity in a quantum context and why it's such an urgent topic today. For one, this is the fact that quantum computers would break public key cryptography is one of the main reasons. It's really the main reason quantum computing has grown to be the field it is today. Up until that point, there was literally just a few people working in this area, and it just was not, it was a very theoretical, esoteric area of computer science and physics. Okay. And then, as I'll explain, you know, Peter Shor realized this will have a profound impact on our entire information and communication system. Therefore, this is an important question, whether we ever could build a quantum computer, when we'll build a quantum computer, and what else can it do. It suddenly became a really, really important problem. And it was also a wake-up call that this really can solve real problems much faster than we know how to do classically versus, you know, completely artificially created problems for the purposes of understanding this new paradigm, which is important. That's how we started. There was very little interest in it back then. Even the prospect of simulating quantum materials didn't get enough people excited. But when suddenly it broke the foundation of, you know, cybersecurity, it became a critical question to resolve. Can we really build one? And when will we build one? The reason being, and you know, in the 90s, we thought, you know, we're very vulnerable. Imagine how much more vulnerable we are now. We don't have to imagine, we know. But imagine how much more vulnerable we're going to be in 10, 15 years. There's very few aspects of our lives where there isn't some cyber technology involved, or where there isn't some vulnerability. And therefore, cybercrime, cyber attacks are just a more and more fundamental part of what it means for society to be safe. Okay. So we want to take advantage of everything this connected world and our ICT systems offer us, but we do have to realize there's a flip side in that there's tremendous vulnerability now. Yep.
It's maybe a stupid question, but what exactly do you mean by cyber?
It's a term that, I mean, a lot of people don't like, but it's really referring to any sort of information, communication, technology, you know. Yeah. So information security, let's say, or software security for information communication technologies, one of the foundational pillars is cryptography. So one of the things we benefit from today is a common shared communication infrastructure. Like, we like to use the internet. We like to use wireless communication. We don't own it. We don't control it. We don't trust it. We all share it. So there's one internet, and we all get to send bits around almost for free to various parts of the world. And we all benefit. We're all leveraging this common infrastructure. The only way you can take your information and put it into some totally untrusted system and still trust that your information remains confidential whenever you want it to be confidential, or that it maintains its integrity. So how do you know your emails and your bank transfers aren't being changed and diverted to different accounts and so on? So it's not just the confidentiality of your electronic, you know, bank transactions. You also want to maintain their integrity. How do you know that? How's that even possible? Well, cryptography is the tool that lets you get trusted results from an untrusted infrastructure. Right? It's the only way we know how to do that. You can always, without crypto, you have to rely on trust and physical security. You put your message in a briefcase, somebody you trust takes it somewhere into another trusted area and hands it to someone else you trust. That's possible. That's how we did it. That's how we do it without crypto. But if you want to be able to not fully trust the media that's storing the information or the people handling your information, you need cryptography. We use it every day. You know, you do auto updates on all your devices essentially every day. How do you know that that software that is supposed to be an upgrade to some program you're fine with, how do you know it's really from the vendor that you at least implicitly trust? How do you prevent anybody from just pretending to be that vendor and downloading whatever malware they like on your computer? Now, none of us do this consciously, but this is what is happening all the time. It's checking checking a signature that verifies that it came from an appropriate source and that it hasn't been tampered with. You need to know both the origin and the integrity of the information. You don't particularly care if somebody's reading someone. You may care, but the first order, you're not worried about somebody else knowing, getting the latest upgrade to Microsoft's operating system. You're not personally worried about the confidentiality, but you do want integrity. Cryptography is also the only link in sort of the security chain that is susceptible to record now and decrypt later. So when messages are going through the cloud or the internet and so on, if somebody, some organization is recording that information, they can bank it. And if later the crypto you were using becomes susceptible to attack, cryptanalysis, they can read it. All the other vulnerabilities that we hear about today in the newspapers and on the news, they're very limited window of vulnerability. If you want to take advantage of what's known as a zero-day attack, the network vulnerability, you have to do it in real time on the system. You can't record the traffic and do it later. So there are many other vulnerabilities to our security, and almost all the hacks we see today, the ones we know of, are not because of cryptanalysis. They're because of implementation flaws, because of advanced persistent threats, malware, and so on. And this is just, cryptanalysis is sort of, the crypto is the building block, and the way people are breaking in is how these systems fit together or the details of how flaws in the implementation of these building blocks. So we're not currently, to our knowledge, experiencing a lot of pain or destruction because of cryptanalysis. But if it were to break, then the whole system would break. And over the years, there have been unexpected advances in the algorithms to break ciphers. So famous ones in the Second World War, the Nazis, you've probably heard of Enigma and Alan Turing and other, and the French and the Poles and Alan Turing's work on breaking Enigma. Those were tactical messages. The strategic information was sent with a much harder code from a family of codes called the Fish Codes. See, my colleague, he was in England at the time, but he eventually moved to Toronto and then Waterloo. He was able to infer, without even having a device, how the device worked and how to cryptanalyze it. And Colossus was built to implement this cryptanalytic algorithm. And this is regarded as one of the greatest intellectual feats of the Second World War. So this was fortunate for the Allies that they were able to cryptanalyze what was thought to be an unbreakable cipher. In more modern times, my colleague Alfred Menezes gave a nice talk about that there haven't been any catastrophic, shocking cryptanalytic failures in the era of modern cryptography, which started roughly in the late 70s. But there have been, several examples where weaknesses were found and they were generally patched before anyone really started exploiting the weakness. Not a lot, but there have been a few, and Alfred sketched a number. I guess I'll just leave these notes up there for you to reference. But his point is we do have to be very careful as we transition to new codes, because there often are unexpected advances that enable cryptanalysis. So I'll get a bit back to that a bit more later. So the vulnerabilities to our information systems, our communication systems, are unexpected. Okay. Again, cryptography has typically not been the main vulnerability, but all the network security flaws, people realized that side channels were a vulnerability. For many years, people knew they, in theory, could be a vulnerability, but in the late 90s, it was demonstrated. So side channels are other degrees of freedom that you're not, you define your zeros and ones, and maybe algorithmically this code is unbreakable. But then when you actually, so you're probably familiar with you may be familiar with the one-time pad, where it involves, so your message, some string of zeros and ones, and your key is some other string of zeros and ones, right? And you take the exclusive OR of these two. So you add them mod 2. So 0 plus 1 is 1. 0 plus 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, so this is your ciphertext. Now, zeros and ones are some physical signal. And people have shown that the 0 you get by adding 1 plus 1 has a slightly different physical signature than the 0 you get from adding 0 plus 0. The wave packet, the packets have a slightly different shape. You can, not deterministically, but you can get a pretty good, by looking at the zero, how it's physically encoded, because it's not just literally a bit, it's a whole packet. You can have a pretty good guess as to whether it was from a 0 plus 0 or a 1 plus 1, for example. So these are sorts of side channels. Other side channels include the power consumption. When you add a zero, when you flip a bit, it maybe draws a little more power than when you don't. So if you're very carefully monitoring the power consumption of the person doing the encryption, you can actually start to infer the key. Timing is another thing. Sometimes the bit might get there slightly sooner if the key was a one than if it was a zero, for example. So you can analyze all these physical parameters, which are not in the model. So your theorems don't apply. So these are other unexpected vulnerabilities. These are pretty sophisticated ones. Network security flaws, just coding mistakes, like in Heartbleed and so on, are the more likely ones typically. But we're constantly facing new unexpected vulnerabilities. Surely the biggest vulnerability was that the new paradigm of physics would have an impact, right? Because the new paradigm for physics led to a new paradigm for computation. And as you've learned throughout this course, there's all sorts of wonderful applications for designing and simulating new materials and drugs, optimizing the allocation of resources by, say, using quantum searching. I don't know if anybody's taught how to use it for metrology or anything. So quantum devices, the reason it's hard to build a quantum computer is because quantum bits are very, very sensitive. So people are finding ways to turn them into really good sensors. So there are serious ideas for using it for, precise medical imaging, improved neutron interferometry, and so on. I believe somebody's already talked to you about quantum communication or QK quantum cryptography, and surely many things we haven't discovered yet. So there's a huge push to build quantum computers, except as we learned in the previous lectures, it will break. It will. You can factor efficiently with a quantum computer, and that's a premise for public key cryptography, the main tool we use today. The other tool we use for public key crypto is based on what's known as a discrete logarithm problem. Has Richard or anyone explained to you how you use discrete logs to establish keys on the internet?
I think you mentioned it in
passing. Okay. It's really simple. So public, everyone knows, you know, there's a group G. There's a group G. Now there's an element of G. Okay. And so you have Alice, you know, picks a random integer A, positive integer A, computes, well, I should pick another X, computes A to the X and sends this to Bob. Bob picks a random integer Y, again, between, you know, 1 and the order of the group, the order of A in the group, and sends A to the Y over to Alice. So Bob receives Alice's X, A to the X, raises it to the power of Y. So he gets A to the X, Y in that group. Alice receives A to the Y, raises it to the power of X, and also computes A to the X, Y. So this is their secret key, which they can now use in a symmetric key encryption scheme. Okay. And an adversary knows A, everybody knows A, they see A to the X and A to the Y. So the discrete log problem, you're given A and A to the X, you know, find X, okay? So Shor found an algorithm for doing that as well. So he broke, you know, plan A and plan B. There was really no robust deployed alternative to public key crypto in 94 when he found these algorithms. Fortunately, we didn't have quantum computers, but there's a long road ahead to deploy reliable alternatives. So Shor's algorithm takes these factoring and discrete log. There's many discrete log-based schemes. The two that really work in practice are based on the additive group of points on an elliptic curve. And if you take a finite field, GFQ, look at its multiplicative group, doing discrete logs in that group is the other thing that works. But elliptic curve crypto and RSA are the front runners right now. Security, 80 bits of security means you have to do 2 to the 80 work. 2 to the 80 operations to break it using the best known algorithms. So 2 to the 80 is a lot, but it's starting to get within reach. So we want to go beyond 80 bits of security these days. And RSA 1024 gives 80 bits of security against the best known classical attacks. Asymptotically, to get n bits of security, you need an n cubed bit key with RSA, but you only need an n bit key with elliptic curves, order n. Right. So strictly speaking, elliptic curves, you just need to, an n bit key gives you an n over 2 strength. But with a quantum attack, it's essentially negligible amount of security. Yep.
What do you mean by 80 bits are getting in reach? That's 10 to the power 24.
Yeah. I know it's not, I'm not saying it's easy, but if you have.
How does it do that many operations?
Massive parallelism and really, really fast processors. For a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not easy, but it's starting. We're not comfortable with just relying on 80 bits of security anymore. Because sure, it would be super, super expensive to do that. So there's two things. For some really important, keys, some important system, somebody might do that. Like if you can get the private key of a government or Microsoft or some, you know, major entity, you can do a lot of damage or steal a lot of money or whatever you want to do with that. The other thing is, well, what if there's a slightly better algorithm? I think it's 80 bits of security, but actually with my tweaks, I can get it down to 60 or 40. So you do like a little bit of a buffer. But even, but 2 to the 80 is starting to get to within reach of what, so we don't, like nobody's publicly announced that I'm aware of right now, the factoring of a 1,000 bit number, but they're getting close to the point where it's starting to leave our comfort zone. People really want 112 or even 128 bits of security right now. But you're right, you don't have to get too much bigger than that, where really no amount of speed up would ever achieve it. But 80 is sort of not in the comfort zone for people these days. For symmetric key cryptography like AES, quantum computing weakens it but doesn't break it. You can just go to a bigger key and you're probably fine. So who cares? Well, these protocols underlie, you know, secure web browsing, auto updates, VPN, secure email, and so on. Essentially, all the computing systems we use today. So it would be very, very bad if these systems were broken without a fix. Now, many people will note, well, quantum computers, they're still many, many years away, so why can't we just ignore this for now? Well, whether or not you can ignore it depends on, first of all, what's the security shelf life of your information? If you're talking about confidential information, trade secrets, your health information, national secrets that are supposed to be secure for 20 years plus, let that be X, okay? So usually X is zero. We don't need to protect things for a long time or 5 years, but often it's much more than 10 or 20 years. Not often, sometimes. Another thing people don't always realize is it takes many, many years to migrate your cryptographic systems to new systems. So for example, DES took over a decade, and some people are still using what's known as triple DES, even though all the experts say, get rid of it. It's you know, it's not as reliable as AES, switch to AES. It's available, it's standardized, it's almost, you know, it's the same, similar performance. So migrating from a new way of doing things from the current system to new systems can take many, many years. Just imagine the Y2, you might not remember, but you may have heard of the Y2K problem in the late 90s, right? Where, you know, we just assumed, you know, 2000 seems so far in the future, computer programs are written where when the year 2000 would come, the software might crash. I mean, that's really trivial. I mean, that's not rocket science, right? And there's no adversary there. But it took many years for people to find all the places where this could affect the code and fix it. This is a much, much harder task. So Y could be many years, from 5 to 15 years, depending on the complexity of your system. And Z is the collapse time. When will quantum computers really break your system? So for the next Y years, you're stuck with these quantum vulnerable tools, right? Everything, your laptops, your internet, everything is using stuff that we know can be broken by a quantum computer. We haven't had time to fix it yet. But you're supposed to be providing X years of security. So if X plus Y is bigger than Z, you already have a problem. Okay? There's going to be a point in the future where you have no choice but to either stop doing business or not provide the X years of security. So you want to avoid that. We want to avoid that. And we definitely want to avoid Y bigger than Z. We don't want systems to collapse and the solution isn't available yet. So what is Z? I mean, most people don't know what benchmarks to look for. What are you looking for, like, what are the harbingers of a quantum computer that could threaten cryptography? They're a bit subtle, right? People ask simple things like, how many qubits do you have? How big of a number have you factored? Those are essentially irrelevant metrics. Not completely, but they're almost entirely irrelevant. So our friends at Yale, Devorah and Shilkov, outlined seven stages towards building a quantum computer. The first stage is find some single qubits, you know, and do lit single gates. Then do multiple qubit operations. And then do measurements and control and the basic building blocks of error correction. And they've done this in ion traps and superconducting qubits and a couple other platforms. What they're trying to do now, and I think they could potentially be very close, is demonstrate a fault-tolerant qubit, a logical qubit in a system that could in principle be scaled. That's what people are trying to do. The building blocks have all been done. They've all been done with high fidelities, but you have to actually do it in the same system at the same time and in a platform that you have a chance in hell of scaling. So that's what people are trying to do. This could happen soon. And when that happens, then the stages 5, 6, 7 are more and more about engineering. Now, Shulkop, I've seen him talk about this. He's saying we're going to keep building the foundation. It's not like we're going to stop coming up with better qubits and better error correction and so on. Of course, we're going to keep improving it. We might replace the vacuum tube, speaking metaphorically, with a transistor eventually. So we're going to keep doing better and better physics. But in parallel, people are going to be scaling these designs. So the question right now is, how close are we to this fault-tolerant, scalable design? And I think we could be very close. If you track the fidelities and what people are doing, if you go to the APS meeting this month, I think you're going to see yet another suite of non-trivial steps towards this goal. You know, IARPA is giving groups money for this. An important part that I work on is more on the software side. So there's two questions. For when will if you want to know when a quantum computer will break RSA, you have to know when will you have a big enough quantum computer, but you also have to know, well, how big is big enough, right? And sure, we have algorithms, but how many logical qubits do they need? Can we optimize those? But how many physical qubits do you need to implement those qubits and those gates? There's several layers of compilation in between. And we've developed a number of tools to vastly improve the efficiency with which we can go from logical circuits to fault-tolerant gates. And my other colleagues are working on better ways to do fault tolerance with these noisy qubits. Right? We have people working on better control pulses to make use of the physical layer that we have, and so on. So there's a whole software tool chain that is continually improving and has an impact on when quantum computers will break modern-day cryptography. Of course, on a more positive note, it has an impact on when we'll be able to use quantum computers to solve these hard problems in material design and drug design and optimization. Yeah, that's the positive reason we want to study this tool chain. We have to monitor this when we're estimating when crypto is going to be broken. So I've ventured out, because my colleagues in industry said, we're going to keep ignoring you because you know someday you might break. You know, it's all so vague and nebulous. There's no way they could go to their boss and their boss's boss and say, we must deal with this threat. We don't even have a timeline estimate. And we always said, well, we don't know. Like, there's so many uncertainties. And they're like, we don't need to know for sure. We just need some rough idea of when it might happen. So I've been thinking of, I've been tracking this for a long time. And I've been talking to people privately about it. But in the last couple of years, I've been voicing my personal opinions on this publicly. So in 96, I said, for the next 20 years, I wouldn't worry about it. I think it's 20 years where we'll have 20 qubits. And that's more or less on track. But a couple years ago, less than a couple years ago, I've been saying, look, there's a small but non-negligible chance that it could happen in a decade. And I think more likely than not, it'll happen in 15 years. Now, my colleagues who try to build quantum computers think this is awfully optimistic. Okay, they don't rule it out. But you know, I do talk to people in fault tolerance, people who are building devices. Some think this is optimistic. Some think it's realistic. I mean, some think it's pessimistic, but not too many. Not too many who know what they're talking about think this is pessimistic. I think generally these are pretty realistic estimates, consistent with what Microsoft speculates as well. Of course, it could be a lot longer. It could be harder. Something could go wrong. I mean, I do factor that into my analysis, but I don't think we can risk just waiting another 10 years and seeing what happens. Because once we're really sure it's going to happen, you don't have enough time to respond. So some of my work has been in developing this tool chain to help us use quantum computers, and that information informs people who want to estimate when they'll actually be able to solve certain problems. Some of my other work is on building the solutions side. So there's two families of solutions. One is just conventional crypto. Instead of factoring or discrete logs, is there some other math problem you could use to establish keys? That's often called post-quantum cryptography or quantum-resistant algorithms. So they're not algorithms like I was teaching. They're cryptographic algorithms. They're protocols. And the nice thing about these is you just use conventional. These are just regular bits. You can use regular computers, regular smartphones, wireless, copper, fiber, we don't care. As long as you can send zeros and ones, you can do this crypto. Quantum crypto needs quantum bits. So it's a subset of our communications infrastructure. But I think it fills a really valuable niche. You know, there's things you can do together. You can use this very efficient system to certify, to authenticate your quantum cryptography. Because quantum cryptography needs to be authenticated as well. But the authentication is a very real-time thing. Somebody breaks the authentication 5 years later, who cares? I just need to know I'm talking to you right now. And then we establish a key, and then those keys are secure indefinitely unless somebody can break the encryption algorithm. But with QKD, as long as you can't break the authentication real time, you're fine. So it's a great enabler to say you can use public key infrastructure to authenticate QKD and get the benefit, the efficiency of public key cryptography, classical public key crypto, and the long-term confidentiality or long-term security of quantum keys. Quantumly generated keys. The keys are classical at the end of the day. We developed a terminology called quantum safe. So we had a bit of a communication gap. Like, we really want the actual practice to change here. So it doesn't suffice that I can convince my mathematician, computer scientists, physics, and engineering colleagues that something should happen, because nobody really listens to us to first order. So we have a problem of communicating to applied security people, applied engineers, you know, business people, policymakers. So we developed a term called quantum safe, which means it's safe in the air with large scale quantum, or belief designed to be safe is probably more accurate. Of course, there's always a chance stuff is broken. So designed to be safe in the air with large scale quantum computers. Other people call it post-quantum, which means exactly the same thing, designed in an era with quantum computers. Except I think most people are thoroughly confused by what that means. I mean, I don't have strong emotional feelings about it. I'm just being very pragmatic about coming up with a term that people might actually know what you're talking about. There's no perfect term, to be clear. Quantum resistant isn't bad, but I think it also suggests that you can break it. It just resists for a little bit. I don't know. I'm not totally against the term. But by quantum safe, we also include quantum cryptography. We want tools that are practical today, but will protect us against the attacks of tomorrow. Okay, so I guess the point I want to make is, if we procrastinate, we're not just looking at some cyber punches to the face. We're talking about core global infrastructure, systemic risk, okay? I may be exaggerating a little bit, but not a lot. Okay, we're talking about systemic risk at the very core of all our ICT systems. Because it's very complicated even if the science and math is done, the hard part is ahead of us in terms of actually getting this integrated into real world systems. Because there's no short-term rewards in the business world, the political world. Nobody gets, you know, brownie points in the short term. So guess what? It tends not to happen. Even though, you know, it's like climate change. It just doesn't happen, even though everyone logically knows something should happen. Standards are a really important part of it, because who cares if you have a great solution, but nothing works anymore because it doesn't interoperate. So there's a lot of work we're doing on the standards front. The biggest bottlenecks here, as with most of the hard problems facing humanity, are not the STEM problems. They're all the social, the business, the political problems. If you want security, you have to make it a business priority. And you have to design it in and go through that long-term disciplined approach of including security into your systems. And this is where we've all struggled and we continue to struggle. Because security is a funny thing, because there's no short-term benefits to security. It's like selling a really good painkiller is a lot easier than trying to sell health food and vitamins. Right? You can look at what makes more money, right? Because when you're in pain, you want a painkiller. You want something that'll fix that problem immediately. This preventative stuff is never really tremendously lucrative business. So that's unfortunately prevents us from having a stronger cyber infrastructure than we could and should. But the standards community I've been very involved in, as with a number of my colleagues at Waterloo, we've been making some very good progress, creating awareness and following next steps to get these potentially quantum resistant tools into practical application eventually. Our friends in the United States have done some very important work in this space. They're driving a project which aims to standardize several of these solutions in the early 2020s. It's motivating people to actually study these alternatives, because we shouldn't trust a new cryptographic tool if it hasn't been scrutinized by the world's best mathematicians and computer scientists. So it's great work going ahead. There's awareness happening, which starts to create a little bit of the momentum to get people to take these, looking at these codes, benchmarking them, testing them seriously. I'm going to leave you the slides for the rest of my talk. There's a risk that quantum cryptography gets left behind. Okay, most practical security people think quantum cryptography is this you know, curiosity for technology enthusiasts, but not really a serious part of our future cryptographic infrastructure. I think that would be a shame. I think we should design our system to allow us to use quantum crypto and let the technology go where it goes. So I guess I'll wrap up soon. The point I want to make is where we are right now is a historical anomaly, really. Okay. Normally in the real world, if it ain't broke, nobody bothers to fix it. Okay. It's good enough. Unless people are dying, literally, we'll work on something else. Right? But now we know it's just a fluke that it's not that we built quantum computers and then suddenly somebody realized this breaks our cyber infrastructure and, you know, the internet goes down and financial global, you know, payment systems go down and other critical infrastructures go down and so on because of this unexpected attack that we don't know how to fix in any short order. That didn't happen. Instead, Peter Shor realized with pen and paper that when we eventually build this device, it will break our current infrastructure. That rarely happens, that we have such a clear view of what's going to happen with so much lead time. So we have an opportunity to design a cryptographic foundation that's far better than we ever had, right? And we have plenty of time to do it properly. And I really hope and think we should take advantage of that. So I've been certainly proselytizing a lot and doing a lot of the research underpinning this stronger cryptographic foundation. That doesn't mean we're going to live in this utopia where there's no more hacking. There's going to be tons of hacking. But if you have strong crypto, at least you have a fighting chance. Okay? If you instead, there's two things that could happen. Well, several things. But roughly speaking, we wait way too long. The crypto's broken and solutions are not deployed. Then there's systemic collapse of cyber systems. I hope that we'll avoid that. But another bad outcome would be everyone keeps procrastinating because they have much more important things to do, and then there's a last-minute rush to deploy something. When you rush, you're going to make a ton of mistakes. And it's the mistakes in our deployment of the protocols and the implementation of the software that we're suffering from today. That's what people are using to hack into our systems today, as far as we see. So we don't want a really messy, buggy cryptographic foundation, because then we're going to have the cyber attacks of the future will be much worse and more frequent than we see today. What I want to see, what I think we should see, is a disciplined, methodical transition to robust tools that have been heavily, you know, vetted for. Okay, I'll leave, you know, my notes on. I'm also like public defender of quantum cryptography. I'm not really a quantum cryptographer. It's not my background. I'm more on the conventional ciphers, and I study algorithms for breaking them. But I do think quantum crypto is a great tool to add to the cryptographic ecosystem. So I think we have this bizarre, unexpected opportunity to make a cryptographic foundation that's much stronger than we ever thought was possible, and then we have. And very importantly, we need it. Because we just kind of, you know, we just keep building stuff. Who imagined in the 80s and 90s that the internet would be at the basis of everything? Right? There'd be an internet of everything. So there's much more at stake. It wasn't designed to be secure. It wasn't designed for our lives to depend on it, right? For all of our lives to be so exposed on it, okay? It wasn't designed for it. So it's really hard, but it's really hard to fix something once it's deployed and being used by everybody. But we have a chance to at least fix a piece of it. So I think we really should take advantage of it because there's so much more at stake than we ever imagined, especially a decade from now. So as I tell people, the choice is ours. We can fully embrace the benefits of quantum technology and be safe against quantum attacks if we if we plan for it. So this is often, you know, what I'll give the general audience, in that there's some low-hanging fruit, which is just ask people, is this stuff going to be safe when quantum computers come? Just get vendors and so on and policymakers thinking, and start encouraging and incentivizing the long-haul path towards making our systems resistant to quantum attacks. You want to start, again, cryptography is really just a tool for mitigating, for risk mitigation. There's many other risks, and often they'll say, well, nobody's really going to do that to steal $100. So they often will just accept the risk. Cryptography is a means for mitigating the risk. You can also transfer the risk by buying insurance. So it's just one tool for mitigating cyber risk. So it's important for people to start now and figure out, take a risk management approach to dealing with this threat, I think. And start, you know, making sure the tools we need for our systems are available when we need them. So to help drive this forward, because, you know, four years ago I talked to a local vendor, a local, you know, security company. He was totally sold. He's like, yeah, what do we do? How do I include this in my product? Then I realized there's nothing you can do, right? Because you do not, I mean, it's a company of five people. There's two programmers. I'm like, you don't have the resources to hire five postdocs and PhDs who can actually understand these research papers, implement the code reliably. Like, that's hard, hard, hard stuff. And it's so easy to screw it up. So I realized, yeah, there's nothing you can do right now. So then I said, the research community should do it, you know, because we understand the papers, implement the stuff and make it available in an open source platform, kind of like OpenSSL. It's open so people can scrutinize it, make sure there's no backdoors, find the bugs, benchmark it and test it and so on, test it inside applications. So this is something we launched earlier last year. So to wrap up, quantum mechanics forces us to reinvent the foundations of our crypto infrastructure. We have to be resistant to quantum attacks to be resistant to cyber attacks in the future. We have this, because of a fluke, we have this head start. We really, really should, as a society, take advantage of it. Thanks for your listening. Hope that was interesting for you. I'm happy to take questions and discuss with any of you offline as well.
Well, let's thank you.